Hello, I'm Roy Jenkins. Welcome to All Things Considered. For the triumph of evil, it's only necessary for good people to do nothing. No one apparently knows who first said this and in what form, but it's been repeated so often that it's now an unchallengeable piece of accepted wisdom. The problem, in many situations, is not that doing something isn't desirable, it's knowing what that something is. The question raises itself with the theme adopted for this week's Holocaust Memorial Day. For 15 years, it's marked the greatest atrocity of World War II, maybe of history. This year, the focus is wider, under the slogan, "Don't Stand By." But in a world where terrible deeds make headlines every week, just what are we expected to do? What does it mean not to stand by? And in particular, not to stand by when people are being persecuted for their race or culture or religion. I'm joined from a London studio by the chief executive of Holocaust Memorial Day, Olivia Marx-Waldman. And with me here in Llandaff is Abdul Azim Ahmed, who's Assistant Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Wales. And we've two guests on the phone, two different phones, that is. Bishop Angelos is General Bishop of the Coptic Orthodox Church in the United Kingdom. And Nick Page is Creative Resources Director for the charity Open Doors, whose annual World Watch List highlights the 50 countries where it's reckoned to be most difficult to live as a Christian. Olivia, Holocaust Memorial Day, why the move from simply commemorating the Holocaust?
When Holocaust Memorial Day was established in the UK, it was very clear that the Holocaust would take centre stage and would be the prime focus of the day. As you said, it was the world's most traumatic experience and has been described as something that shook the foundations of civilization, which I think is a very powerful phrase. But one of the lessons we learn from it is that despite its reach and its atrocity, genocides have happened since then. So from the inception, Holocaust Memorial Day has marked the genocides that have taken place since in Cambodia, in Rwanda, in Bosnia, and ongoing in Darfur. And every year, the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust chooses a different theme that will enable people to learn something more from history and think what lessons we can draw from that today. What more can we do? And this year we wanted to choose the theme, Don't Stand By. We want people to learn what happened. The Holocaust didn't come out of nowhere. Neither did any of the subsequent genocides. They happened because increasing persecution took root and people tolerated these insidious levels of oppression. And within that culture, it became very, very difficult to speak out against it, a matter of real threat to somebody's personal safety or even their lives, and often reprisals against their families.
And you are wanting people not to stand by in cases which don't simply involve oppression because of who a person is, but because of their race, because of their learning disability, maybe because of their gender, whatever.
Absolutely right. What can we do today not to stand by when we see people being persecuted because of the community they belong to, the faith that they have?
Fine. Azim, how do you react to this?
I think this year's theme is a really pertinent one, because when I first heard about the theme, Don't Stand By, the first thing that came to my mind was a teaching of the Prophet Muhammad, which said, you know, help your brother, whether he is oppressed or oppressor. And the question, of course, was how do you help your brother when he's oppressor? And the response was by stopping him from committing that action. And I think for me, Don't Stand By is a reminder, not just about, you know, not being a passive voice when things are taking place such as oppression or persecution, but also the reminder that, you know, sometimes it's standing up against your own, standing up against your co-religionists, your friends, your family, people you work with who might be contributing to this persecution rhetoric, you know, through words or through action. And it's your responsibility to maybe take a stand against that as well.
Bishop Angelos, how do you react to this don't stand by message?
I think when we look at others as others, then it's very easy to see them suffering and think their suffering must be different to ours. The first thing we need to realize is humanity, and within a Christian perspective, we're all created in the image and likeness of God, with the same image and likeness across the board, and there is the same sanctity of life shared by all. So if I see the life of every person before me as holy and valued and therefore protectable and defendable, then I look at everyone's life being the same, and I wouldn't be able to tolerate the genocide or persecution or the danger befalling any person whoever that person is and from whatever race or religious background they come.
Yeah. Nick Page, this broadening of the theme for this day, does it disturb you at all, or does that encourage you that everybody observing this is meant to take a much wider view of what it means to be persecuted for some reason or other?
No, it doesn't disturb me at all. I think it's really, really important, and it's one of the most key things that we have to take out of lessons of history, particularly the lessons of the Holocaust, because it's disturbingly easy to think that that was just that one, so that's just this unique historical event and could not be replicated. And of course the truth is that it can be replicated around the world, and we have to remain vigilant about that. And in terms of not standing by, I remember the first time I went to Dachau in Germany, what alarmed me was that the site was 15 minutes basically north of Munich. It's just very right in the heart. And it could only exist because people stood by. And what I'd like to say is that at no point in history has it been easier to make a noise about this kind of thing.
Azim, to what extent do you see Islamophobia present here in Wales, in the United Kingdom generally?
There are many people who I know, especially it seems to be targeted very much at Muslim women, identifiable Muslim women, so they're wearing the headscarf or something similar. They've had experiences of abuse on the street. They've had experiences of abuse on public transport. And so it's part, I think, of a much wider shift in rhetoric. We've seen in Britain and I think in Europe where there's suspicion around Muslims, there's suspicion around migrants and refugees, and there's a hardening of the way in which they're discussed. And I think the place where we really do need to take an active stance against this kind of rhetoric is when people's humanity is undermined, when people are refugees or Muslims or anyone really is talked about as being somehow less human.
You're talking at the moment largely, though, about things that people say.
Yes.
Rather than things that the people do.
That's right, yeah. And I think the two are linked. What people say often leads into an environment where people can do things. Once you undermine someone's humanity, you know, abusing them, it's not going against anyone's morality. These people aren't human, so to speak.
But Bishop Angelos, you've pointed out that Christian population of the Middle East is down from 25% to 5%, and 80% of that 5% are in Egypt, in your country. You've spoken about ethnic cleansing. Some people are very alarmed at that.
Yes, that is the case, and these are statistics. Of course, Middle East statistics are always variable depending on the source, but with a broad range of understanding, that is right. We heard earlier about a desensitization. We become more immune to acts of aggression happening, to marginalization, to alienation. And, as Abdulazim just said, it starts with what people say, and then it turns into policy, then it turns into action. And we get this dehumanization, this marginalization, and people push limits and push boundaries. So if it's acceptable to treat people as second-class citizens, that's fine. The next step comes, well, can we persecute them a bit more? The next step comes, can we start to decide whether they deserve to live or not live in this place, or indeed at all? And it's a cumulative process. And if we don't pick it up, if we are silent, if we stand by, then I think indirectly, and as horrible as it sounds, we are implicitly responsible for that as well.
You've argued that the silence of churches as well as of nations and the world community has actually been a contributing factor to this.
I think it's churches that have seen this happening to brothers and sisters around the world. It's Muslim leadership that has seen things happen in its name and haven't responded. It's the world community. It's a lot of people, and we all need to work together. The Holocaust was a crime against us all. What's happening in the Middle East is a crime against us all. Islamophobia is a crime against us all. And as a humanity now, we live in this global village where we can no longer separate ourselves from others. And I'm always reminded of Nir Mollah's statement where when we're quiet about what happens to others, by the time it happens to us, there's no one left to defend us.
Nick Page, your organisation, Open Doors, produces this World Watch List, which talks about the 50 most dangerous countries for Christians. That report said at the end of last year that persecution had been more intense in more parts of the world than in any previous reports that they've produced. Where is it worse, then? What are the countries at the top of the list?
Number one and it's been number one for 14 consecutive years, is North Korea. And if you want to sort of look at it in terms of genocide, it's almost impossible to know quite the extent to which Christians are being targeted in North Korea. Certainly, there is no sense in which you could be publicly a Christian. If you're found owning a Bible, you'll be shipped off either to a labor camp or to a remote village. So it has a lot of the characteristics of genocidal kind of behavior in the attempt to expunge either a national, ethnic, or racial or religious group, as genocide is normally termed. That's certainly their aim. But one of the things I find most disturbing is the attempt to rewrite history, as it were. That it's not just about expunging the people from the place that they live, but an attempt almost to kind of completely wipe out any historical trace. And we saw that with ISIS blowing up the monastery of St. Elijah near Mosul.
Olivia, this will ring bells for you as a Jewish person in terms of the way in which Jewish people were treated.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm wondering to what extent the decision to broaden the campaign this year might cause some people to say, well, actually, this is out of all proportion. I mean, we are remembering the murder of 6 million people and all the horrendous things which happened in association with that. Isn't it a bit out of proportion to be asking me to think about, someone who's insulted in the street because of a particular lifestyle which they have chosen, maybe, or not chosen, but it is their lifestyle, and so on?
The Holocaust is absolutely at the centre of Holocaust Memorial Day and always has been. And the reflections and commemorations on subsequent genocides have always been there. And Holocaust Memorial Day has always been a very dynamic day. We say that Holocaust Memorial Day is a day to learn from the past in order to create a better future. It's remembering for a purpose. So every year, when we learn about what happened in the past, we always challenge ourselves to think, what can we do as a result of what we have learned? What are our responsibilities today? And I think the theme that we've chosen this year brings that even more starkly to the forefront of our minds. But every year we're asking people to think about what their responsibilities are. And I think the response we've been having has shown us just how much people want to do that, how much they want to take from what they've learned in the past and do more about it this year. And the survivors we speak to are very driven by sharing their life stories and wanting people to create a world where genocide is less likely to happen and where we see a better society around us. And they've been responding hugely positively to this theme as well.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to All Things Considered on BBC Radio Wales, and we're discussing Holocaust Memorial Day and its theme this year, which is Don't Stand By. But what can we do? That's the issue, Bishop Angelos. I mean, some say, well, it's all very well to say don't stand by, but, you know, these are huge, enormous problems. What can governments do? Perhaps they've got to do most of it. But what can I do? What difference can I make?
We have a responsibility to speak where we see inequality, where we see injustice. It can't just be happening to somebody else or on our television screens or in our newspapers, and so therefore it matters slightly less. When we're sitting and looking at news items, we have the comfort and the ease of changing channels or turning the page. But when we look at people who are actually suffering, it's important for us to do something for them. You know, there's a very clear balance, and it's a very fine line between people living in anger and people living in victimhood. And so we need to help people to realize that they have another option. And that option is, if they are unable to act, then we should be able to speak for them. You know, there's a catch cry that's used by so many about being a voice to the voiceless, has almost become cliche. But it is actually the reality. We need to be a voice to those voiceless because we have platforms here. We live in a nation where our politicians listen to us, where we have organizations like Open Doors and others, where we have civil society, where we have a social conscience, where we have human rights. And we need to use that not just for ourselves, but to others who don't have these privileges.
So, Nick Page, I mean, we hear reports of terrible things happening to whole groups of people because of their faith. But what, in practical terms, can a person in this country, say, do for any one of these members of large numbers of groups in the Middle East, in North Africa, or wherever, who are going through terrible persecution? What can you actually do?
Well, I think there's a number of things you can do. I mean, firstly, you can support them. My wife actually also works for Open Door. She was out in Iraq not long back, and they said to her, tell your leaders. And she came back and she suddenly thought, oh, actually, I can do that, because our constituency MP happens to be a man called David Cameron. And so, you know, we have this hotline, we have this amazing privilege that we can actually talk to our MPs. And we had over 102 MPs turn up to the launch of our report in Parliament. And MPs are very engaged about this, so we can speak up for them. We can support them through aid agencies, including Open Doors, who support people around the world who've been persecuted for their faith, either by providing practical aid or legal representation or helping them rebuild churches that have been burned down, all kinds of things like that. And I think actually, just to pick up what Bishop Angela said, we can honour their witness. I believe very strongly that in telling their stories, learning what we can about them, and passing that on to others, and try as far as we can to see a broad picture. You know, we can't fix all these problems. We can't solve the massive problem that there's many tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who are persecuted. But if we can change the lives of one family, that's something.
I mean, I think the question about what we can do really is a very relevant one. And I kind of applaud Holocaust Memorial Day for opening the discussion by saying, well, you know, there are cases where we can actually take a role. And I think religious persecution is especially one where, in the UK at least, I think British Muslim communities and British Christian communities can really start talking to each other about this topic. I think within both faiths, we have a strong sense of solidarity with our co-religionists across the world. But there is a danger to that, of course. I mean, talking about Muslims, sometimes Muslims say, well, you know, Muslims are being bombed in Iraq, they're being bombed in Syria, they're being bombed in Yemen, you know, and it's weapons sold by, you know, the UK or US. And there's this sense of grievance and this sense of a relationship being tainted with your neighbours. And I think the same can happen in reverse. Christians can look to the Middle East and think, well, you know, the Islamic State is doing this in the name of Islam and, you know, this is happening in Pakistan. Whereas I think there is a real call for us here in the UK and a real opportunity for us. And another one which has only been stressed by Holocaust Memorial Day's theme of thinking, well, what can we do together to try and stop religious persecution? The Pew Survey for Religious Harassment, which looks at countries across the world, found that Muslims are persecuted in 109 countries and Christians in 110, and often in the same countries. So we can really find some common ground and think, well, what can we do locally that will make a difference internationally?
Can I jump in here as well, Roy?
Of course, yeah.
We're really lucky in this country. We're not at risk of the kind of international threats. And there are so many opportunities for us to develop positive relations with our neighbours. And where, very sadly, we do see incidents of hate, they're quite often illegal. They are crimes. Mm. And there are very good ways and methods where we can report these incidents. The Tell Mama project reports anti-Muslim incidents. The CST reports anti-Semitic incidents. The government True Visions project makes it easy to report incidents of hate crime. And too often we know incidents of hate are not reported. We were in touch with a Muslim woman from London who had her car tyres slashed, and on her windscreen it was written, "Go home." And at the time, she didn't even report it because she felt too terrified. She was fearful of what might come next. Later on, after some support from a charity, she felt much more able to report it. She attended some workshops and is now a spokesperson within her community. I know an 11-year-old boy who is Jewish who was told to F off in the street and went home with his eyes down and very, very in on himself, very reluctant to walk the high street. Knowing that it had been reported validated his experience and made him feel better. And obviously the police then took it up and were involved. These kinds of things, if they're not reported either by the individuals themselves or by witnesses, then that is where further problems develop. And any of us, if we witness something, can intervene if it's safe to do so. But if it's not, there are still actions we can take that will assist.
Don't stand by is the theme of this day. But Bishop Angelos, there are surely times when it is justifiable to stand by, people would say. You know, we can't always understand the complex situations, and stepping in too soon might make a situation infinitely worse. That could be certainly true of nations going to war. It can be true of individuals trying to get involved where really they don't know what they're talking about.
I'd just like to clarify, I think it's understandable but never justifiable. Because I think we can't always do things, we can't always act, but at least let's not get in there and make things worse. Let's not take rash decisions. And sometimes it is honorable not to do something, not in the context of not doing good, but at least not doing bad and not making things more complex and more difficult. So I think rather than trying to force an ideology or an understanding from outside, telling people how they should live, how they should deal with situations, we need to listen more intently and more sympathetically. And we need to be very careful we don't play to an agenda that we're sometimes victims to. And that is, we're sometimes almost felt that we need to compete for public space. There's no monopoly on suffering. The fact that I recognize the suffering of someone else does not diminish my own. It actually puts me in a position where I can stand in solidarity with others. And so if we avoid this agenda and not play to it, whether it's media or politics or any other platform, if we stand together collectively and fight for an end to this sort of action and an end to this sort of persecution and this sort of violence, then we have a much greater and a much further-reaching collective voice that reaches all our communities, all our nations.
Azim, I'm thinking of this business of, an occasion when it is justifiable to stand by. I'm thinking of this in the context of some of the young people of whom you know a great deal who have actually gone from Britain to fight for ISIS and all the rest of it because they seem to think they were doing something. Is it part of your work, as you see it, to encourage young people to see, look, there are times when there are things you can't do because you can't change this in that way?
I think so. I think the question isn't so much when inaction is necessary, but looking at the actions where impacts and, benefits will come. So if someone did say to me, and I've never actually had this situation arise, but if someone said to me, oh, I'm going to go Syria because I think that's the right thing to do, my question would immediately be, well, who are you helping and are you not in a better position to do so from the UK? I think, again, this sense of solidarity we have with our co-religionists across the world is a good thing because it motivates. And if you look at some of the relief charities, the biggest ones in the world, from CAFOR to Islamic Relief to Christian Aid, they're faith-based charities because of that strong sense of solidarity. So I think there is a question of looking at what is the wisest course of action rather than thinking about inaction.
Nick, why is it important for people other than Christians to take notice of contemporary persecution of the Christian church in various parts of the world?
Because it's about freedom. I believe I'm involved in this work partly because I am a Christian. Obviously, that's a huge motivating force in my life. But also because I believe in personal freedom, freedom to worship in the way that you wish to worship in your home, where you live. So it's a human rights issue. And also I think because, one of the things that I've been aware of is in the past few years is just this growth of fear, identifying people as the other, and demonizing them and becoming scared of them. And actually it's very important to combat that. People are made in the image of God. And they have freedom. They have a divine freedom, a freedom of choice, and we have to honour that.
Bishop Angelos, why do you think that the Christian churches themselves, in some parts of the world and in some expressions of the Christian church, have been very, very slow to take up the cause of persecuted Christians?
I think sometimes it's what you hinted at earlier, and that is it is such a phenomenally painful position and so large that what could I possibly do individually? I don't think that it's people not wanting to act. I think it's them not knowing what to do. But I also think that sometimes it's a lack of understanding of the region, and we tend to explain and understand things only through our own perception. But if we have to put ourselves into the position of the other, so if I'm sitting here as a Western Christian trying to think of a Christian in Syria or Iraq at the moment, what he or she is going through, and try to help from that perception, then I'll be in a much better place, and I'll be in a much better position to understand what they're going through. I then won't be thinking, are they immigrants or are they refugees, but are they people who are genuinely in need and generally in need of my support.
One last question to you, Olivia. The Holocaust is a part of the life of every Jewish person, but I'm just wondering how vivid it still is for Jews in Britain. I mean, your own family, I understand, has been here for a century or more. Mm-hmm. You've been assimilated, your links with families in the rest of Europe largely gone. I mean, how important does it actually remain?
There's an expression that a lot of Jewish people use, which is the oi of being Jewish. You might have heard that oi, oi, oi is a sign of grief, and the joy of being Jewish. The oi of being Jewish is a lot of our history, in particular the Holocaust, and it does loom large in many people's collective memory and contemporary experience. And as you said, my family came here at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, but the members of the families that they left behind largely perished in the Holocaust. At the same time, we are joyful about being Jewish, and there is much to celebrate. But at a time when there is rising anti-Semitism and we see hate incidents in the UK where people are targeted because of their faith or their ethnicity or for other reasons, it does make us nervous. I would say very firmly, though, that in describing the Holocaust as something that shook the foundations of civilization, that has lessons for everybody, and incidents of hate should worry everybody. I think Bishop Angelo mentioned the poem by Pastor Neumüller, and that has huge resonance for everybody, because we are all individuals with a common humanity. And on Holocaust Memorial Day in particular, it's a day we come together and recognise each other's humanity and learn of the humanity of people in the past.
Olivia Marks-Waldman, Bishop Angelos, Abdulazim Ahmed and Nick Page, many thanks. You can hear this programme again or download the podcast by going to our webpage at bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales. All Things Considered will be here at the same time next week, but meanwhile, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.